thank you for having me. I am delighted to be here. This is my first time in Alaska, and I've had a tremendous time. It's a gorgeous country around here. I had a lovely drive from Anchorage, and I've just enjoyed walking around Palmer, exploring the town. It seems a lovely, lovely town. I had some great coffee next door. So I'm very psyched to be here, and so thank you. So I've been asked to talk about Russia and my experience with Russia, which I'm happy to do, but the truth is I can pretty much talk about anything on your mind. You know, I very much often believe that these talks are much more interesting when they're more of a conversation than me just sort of blathering at you. So please feel free to interrupt me at any time, anything that's on your mind, any questions that you have. You know, let's make this much more of a discussion or a conversation or a dialogue. I was, you know, as I was driving up here, I suddenly had the realization that, you know, there but for a quirk of history, we would be in Russia right now, which is, it's really kind of fascinating. And, you know, it just shows how fate and time and geopolitics is highly unpredictable. I have been in the far east of Russia, never that close to Alaska, but, you know, Vladivostok, the area near Japan and South Korea and North Korea and China. But it's just so interesting how, you know, different countries have taken over different parts of this area of the world and how they have just ended up in dramatically different places. Obviously, Russia and Alaska are joined to some extent by climate. As I was researching Palmer, because I was kind of curious about it, I noticed the interesting aspect of agriculture up here and vegetables and how you folks are known for your Titanic cabbages and squash and zucchini. And of course, there's a lot of similarities to certain parts of Russia where the growing season is very, very short, but very, very intense. So I certainly don't think I'm back in Russia right now, but it does have a little bit of that kind of feel. So I spent 5 years in Russia, a year living in St. Petersburg, and 4 years living in Moscow, where I was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times. It was from 2006 to 2011. And I really tried to immerse myself as much as possible into the country, into the culture, into the society. One of the things that I did when I moved to St. Petersburg to learn Russian. I actually didn't know Russian before I moved to Moscow, moved to Russia. And one of the very special things about the New York Times is often when they send you abroad as a foreign correspondent, they will give you a chance to learn the local language. So I took an entire year off and moved to St. Petersburg and lived in St. Petersburg and studied Russian with a tutor 6 hours a day, one-on-one. So I could really learn well enough, hopefully, to be able to function as a foreign correspondent when I got to Moscow. But it was also really an opportunity for me and for my family, I have three children, to really burrow into Russian society and to basically get a much better sense of the culture and the place that we were living. One of the things that we did was my wife and I decided that we were going to try as much as possible to not live the classic expatriate lifestyle. The classic expatriate lifestyle is essentially you move to a place and you can kind of live in a little bit of a bubble. You can kind of spend a lot of time with Westerners or Americans. You can send your kids to the American school where they study in English. And you're sort of in the place, but you're not in the place. The people who decide to do that, they obviously do it for very good reasons, and I don't want to judge it at all because there are certainly places where you have to do that. But in this instance, when we moved to Russia, my wife and I decided that we were going to make the decision that turned out to be quite challenging yet quite rewarding to put our children in a local Russian school. So when we moved there, our children were 9 years old, a 9-year-old daughter, a 7-year-old daughter, and a 4.5-year-old son. We threw them into a local Russian school in St. Petersburg and then in Moscow, and even though they didn't speak a word of Russian. So if you guys are more interested in this, I wrote a story about it for the New York Times Magazine that appeared in 2011, which you can find online. And my wife did a video about it, which is quite an amazing video that kind of shows their experience. For them, it was really an extraordinary gift because they ended up essentially speaking perfectly fluent Russian. They ended up being like every other kid in their school in Moscow, even though when they got to their school in Moscow and St. Petersburg, they were alienated outsiders who didn't speak any of the language, didn't understand what was going on. You know, even to this day, we've been back for 5 years. Their Russian is still pretty good. We get them lessons, and it really changed them in ways that we only every once in a while get a glimpse of. It changed them in the sense of they respond differently to challenges than they might have otherwise if they had not gone to Russia. I know this is a little bit of a tangent from Putin, but I'll get to that in a second. But I just thought it would be a nice way to start in terms of kind of personalizing the experience. Just showing that one of the most important things about being a foreign correspondent is not staying on the superficial exterior of a society. It's really trying to figure out what's going on there. You to some extent become an interpreter, a translator. I don't mean just a translator or interpreter of a language. I mean a translator, an interpreter of a culture, of a society. I often saw myself in Moscow as trying to figure out, what is it that the world should be knowing about what's going on in Russia today, or in other countries of the former Soviet Union? And how can I explain it in a way that's really understandable, that's both sophisticated in the sense that a Russia expert would find it helpful, but also it's just not too sophisticated that a typical general interest reader would find it alienating. And that's really the kind of challenge of being a foreign correspondent. You have to find those things that really will resonate with readers around the world, not just the specialists. And you have to do it in a way that really is particularly engaging and compelling. So when I was in Russia, when I got to Russia, it was a very interesting time because it was essentially Putin had served his first two terms. Putin came to power in 1999 or 2000, depending on how you count it. And he served 2 4-year terms as president. This was really a startling time in Russian history because the 1990s, as you know, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The 1990s were a terrible time there. The economy fell apart. The society was on the brink of complete fragmentation. A country that was essentially strode the world stage as one of two superpowers basically found itself on its knees. Understanding what happened in the 1990s to Russia, to Moscow, it's vitally important to understand what's happening with Russia today. You can kind of imagine if the United States, which has obviously long been the world's greatest superpower, if all of a sudden the United States was no longer the world's great superpower, how the people would feel about that? How would people would feel about the loss of their status, of the loss of their prestige, a loss of the fact that they were really something, somebody? Putin came into power in 1999 almost accidentally. He had been head of the FSB, which is a successor to the KGB, and Boris Yeltsin, who was the president at the time, chose him first to head the FSB and then to be his prime minister. And then when Yeltsin resigned, Putin took over as the acting president and then ran for election himself. No one really realized, I think, in the West, who was this guy and what would he represent. What he ended up representing was the kind of the rise of the old, to some extent, the old school belief in Soviet power or in Russia power. And just to be clear, this is not necessarily just Soviet. This is something that dates back to the time of the Tsars. And I think the other thing that's very important is we can't look at Moscow and Russia just through the lens of the post-Soviet era or even the Soviet era. We have to really look at Russia through the lens of history, of dating well back into the Tsars, of dating well back to, you know, to the time when relations with the West were just as fraught. Russia has always had a very strikingly kind of paradoxical, ambivalent relationship with the West. It both wants to be respected by the West. It wants to be the West. It wants some of what the West has. But at the same time, it's also kind of repulsed by the West and feels that it is something different, that Russia does not feel like it is a Western European country. Russia does not feel that it is certainly an American kind of country. It feels distinct. It feels it's of its own. And we can't really look at what Russia is today or in the past through the lens of kind of the American or Western European understanding of power or nationhood. And I think that's very important to understand. And it's very important to understand when we're looking at Putin. So Putin arrives in 2000, and he, especially as someone who had a background in the security services, who was stationed in East Berlin, in East Germany, under communism, he very much had a real, I think you could almost call it a sense of loss for the decline of Soviet power, for the decline of Russian power, for the decline of the Kremlin and Moscow. And it became very clear in 2000 and in the years after that, that his real ambition, his real mission, his real goal was to reassert Russia on the world stage, was to rebuild Russia. The deep, deep, deep sense of humiliation that Russians, and especially the Russian elite, felt in the 1990s with the collapse of Soviet power, I think in Putin's mind, that would no longer stand. It was very clear that for Putin, addressing that sense of humiliation, righting that wrong, was by far the most important thing. So that meant standing up to America much more than Russia under Yeltsin had. That meant rebuilding the Russian military. That meant especially reasserting what Moscow has felt is its historic zone of influence. And again, that dates well before the Soviet Union. It dates all the way back to the Tsars, that Russia and Moscow historically has felt that it had its own zone of influence. And it was wrong, inappropriate, totally unfair for the West to encroach upon that zone of influence. Just as, you know, the United States felt very upset when the Soviets went to Cuba, Moscow feels similarly about encroaching on its zone of influence. You know, one of the most striking aspects of that is the Baltic states, which, you know, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which have historically kind of ping pong back and forth between the West and the East and Soviet and independence. Those three countries very much never wanted to be part of the Soviet Union. They were essentially taken over by Stalin after World War II. After the Soviet Union collapsed, they were the first ones to essentially assert their own independence. Well, it became very clear through the Yeltsin years and the early part of the Putin years that the fate of the Baltic states was deeply, deeply upsetting to Moscow. They ended up joining NATO, and they ended up joining the EU. And again, that it was akin to Cuba for the United States. It would be like Cuba joining the Soviet bloc or the Warsaw Pact. And I guess Cuba wasn't the Soviet bloc, but specifically the Warsaw Pact. Though that kind of encroachment on the historic Russian, Moscow, Soviet, Tsarist zone of influence was a real, of paramount concern for Putin, for the Russian elite, for the Kremlin. We saw that in the war in Georgia in the summer of 2008, and we specifically have seen that in the last couple of years in what's been happening in Ukraine. I think it's hard to imagine for Americans the feeling that the Russian elite has about Ukraine and about the relationship between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine, to some extent, is considered to be like many Russians considered to be like the little brother or little sister of Russia. And especially in eastern Ukraine, which is filled with many ethnic Russians and many Ukrainians who are Russian speakers, many Russians feel that that is essentially part of Russia. So there has been this constant tug of war between the West and Moscow over the fate of Ukraine. And what happened a couple of years ago, of course, was there was a Ukrainian president who tilted toward Moscow. He ended up tilting too far to Moscow, sparked a revolt. There was a rebellion. He was overthrown. And Ukraine immediately starts falling apart. And these tensions that have existed between Moscow and the West over Ukraine burst into the open. The most obvious example of that was Russian troops went and took over Crimea, which is a peninsula in the Black Sea that historically had always been part of Russia. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, it became part of Ukraine through a kind of an accident of Soviet history. But, you know, the vast majority of Russians, 99% of Russians, even incredibly liberal, progressive Russians, have always thought of Crimea as being part of Russia, not part of Ukraine. Nonetheless, it was essentially an invasion of a foreign country and a usurping of foreign territory by Putin and by the Kremlin. And that just gives you a sense of how Russia has felt, how Moscow, how Putin has felt about these issues, how visceral they are. And I think it's very hard sometimes for Americans to kind of realize that. It just seems like these kind of intramural squabbles among the sort of former Soviet Union or squabbles between Russia and Europe, but actually represents a sort of much larger geopolitical dynamic at work. And again, it's a geopolitical dynamic that extends back hundreds of years. You know, the Tsar controlled Ukraine, and just as Stalin did. And for that reason, many Russians believe that Russia should continue to control Ukraine. Now, at the same time, of course, there are people in Western Ukraine, especially, who are deeply, deeply resentful of Russians. They don't speak Russian, they speak Ukrainian. They're essentially considering themselves Ukrainian patriots, and they really want no part of Moscow. They look to the West. So Ukraine, to some extent, represents the kind of cleaving in the post-Soviet space between the pro-Western part and the pro-Moscow part. I'll take a quick break for questions. What's on your minds? Yes?
Well, you know, when you talk about how Putin has come to power, yeah. You know, and it's been, you know, kind of like a payback of all the humiliation that they've
yes.
Had. Are we seeing, like, you know, what Germany saw in the build-up of World War II? They were so humiliated.
Right. Right.
And then we saw the rise to power again. Within a few years, we were back at World War II.
Right. I wouldn't say I think the analogy has some validity, but not completely. I think there's a lot more nuance there. I mean, I think you can make the argument that after World War I, the Allies really kneecapped Germany in a way that did not occur in the 1990s. In the 1990s, the tremendous amount of aid from the West poured into Russia. The West really went out of its way to help Russia. Now, having said that, in the Russian mind, there was a sense that the West took advantage of Russia. Western oil companies or Western business interests took advantage of Russia. There was also just a sense of humiliation that Russia was no longer a superpower. And don't forget, in 1991, Moscow went from controlling the entire former Soviet Union to controlling just Russia. So, the you know, all of a sudden, you know, 17 countries become one country becomes 17 countries or 16 countries, depending on how you count it. So that kind of humiliation was not caused by the West. I mean, there's this. You can make an argument that the West caused the breakup of the Soviet Union through military buildup and other aspects. But, you know, you can also make the argument that the Soviet Union collapsed just because of ethnic tensions, economic tensions, and, you know, utter political mismanagement. I do think that Russia is much more interested in self-preservation at this point than in global domination like the Nazis were. I also think that, you know, Russia has a tremendous nuclear arsenal, which is a source of great strength for the country. And also, I mean, I think to some extent gives them a little more comfort and makes them a little bit less anxious about encroachment from the West. But I mean, it's a great question because I think that, you know, the aspect of humiliation certainly is similar. You know, the other thing that's worth keeping in mind is what's happening right now. And of course, the other analogy between Russia and Alaska is that governments of both are being walloped by low oil prices. And I mean, when I was in Moscow, the ruble was anywhere from 25 to the dollar at its strongest and 35 to a dollar at its weakest. You know, in recent months, it's gone up to 60, 70, 80 rubles to a dollar. The economy is in real, real difficult shape because it is so reliant upon oil and gas and exports minerals, other natural resources. I mean, that's a big problem for Putin. He can certainly, I mean, when I got to Russia and I moved to St. Petersburg, I had, I mean, I knew that Russia had developed a real modern kind of post-World War II economy after 1991, that had become much more of a consumer society than it had been in the Soviet times. But nonetheless, if you grow up under the Cold War, as I did, you still have seared into your mind this idea that you can't buy a tomato in Moscow, or that, you know, you have to wait online for toilet paper. So I get to St. Petersburg, and this is the summer of 2006. This is the height of the Russian economic boom. Oil is doing really well. The economy is doing really, really well. And I was just kind of astonished at the consumer goods that you could buy in St. Petersburg and Moscow. They had huge big box stores that are just as good as anything in New York. They had an IKEA on the outskirts of St. Petersburg. There's one on the outskirts of Moscow. I went to the IKEA and it was just mobbed. I just couldn't believe how busy it was. And I suddenly had this epiphany, and it was essentially, this is really the source of Putin's power. So, you know, the Russian people had been so, were so exhausted by the economic trials and tribulations of communism. All of a sudden the 90s happened, the economy does very badly, but then it starts rebounding in the late 90s and the early aughts. And Putin is the guy who basically did it. I mean, he basically created an economy that provided for people's consumer needs for the first time, arguably, in the history of Russia. And it's not only consumer goods and the fact that you can buy anything in Moscow today or in the last 10 years that you could in New York. It's also travel. So in the old days, under the Soviet times, travel was very restricted, obviously. It was a benefit. It was given to people for loyalty to the party, and you had to go on these special package tours, and it was very, very restricted. When I got to Moscow and St. Petersburg, there were tours that could be had to resorts in Egypt and Thailand and India and Turkey, $500, one person, a week, airfare, hotel, all the food you can eat, all you could drink. And I went on one with my family because it was so cheap, seemed like fun. And I remember looking up at the departure board at the airport in St. Petersburg, and there were just dozens of planes leaving for these resort areas, dozens. So travel had become like a classic middle-class staple that everyone was doing. And of course, as you know, the Russian winters ain't so great. I don't have to tell you guys that, right? And so the ability to suddenly say the ability for middle-class people to suddenly say, hey, I got supermarkets bursting with goods and fruits and vegetables and meat and anything I could want, all the electronics I can want, big TVs, everything. I can go to a resort in Thailand for, you know, $800 for a week, chartered airfare, full hotel, et cetera, et cetera. Life is pretty good. That was really the compact between Putin and his people. And that is really at the heart of his stability and the heart of his ability to remain in power. People do like the fact that he is now standing up for Russia. He's now standing up for America, standing up to America. But what they really love is the fact that they can buy stuff now. And, you know, there's the old joke, if you give someone freedom of speech, the first thing they're going to ask is, where's the food? I think it's very important to understand that about Russian society right now and Russian culture, because, you know, there have been crackdowns on democracy and freedom of speech and all that stuff. It's very nuanced, and I'm happy to talk more about that. But leaving that aside for a second, the real thing, the real secret to Putin's success is maintaining a society with consumer goods. The problem for him now, of course, is the more oil stays, if oil continues to stay very low, it really causes a lot of problems for the federal budget, which is, you know, largely based on oil revenue. And that will hurt all sorts of government spending. That will have a ripple effect on the economy. And if that really starts hurting middle class incomes and middle class their ability to buy all the stuff that they've loved now for the last 15 years, that could, for the very first time, have an impact on his popularity. And that remains to be seen. It's still pretty early. They're obviously hoping that the price of oil will go back up, as I'm sure you guys. If it doesn't, I think it's going to be challenging. Other questions? Yes, David.
Russia's not a particularly safe place for journalists. What level of protection did you feel you had being there during the time? Mm-hmm. Other journalists operating in the country didn't have. And what, if any, were the differences or kind of the rules of engagement with sources in terms of like going on background or using anonymous sources, where the consequences for them and you could be considered more harsh?
Yeah. It's a great question. One of the interesting aspects of the work that I did in Russia is that while Russia is a dangerous place for journalists, there's a real difference between being a foreign correspondent in Russia and being a local journalist. In general, the Russian authorities didn't really care that much if you published something in English. It's if when you started publishing something in Russian, A, and if you started going at their personal corruption, the money that they were stealing, and this tremendous government corruption in Russia, that is when you got into more trouble. So I was not cavalier about the threats to my safety in Moscow. I mean, I was careful. But in general, I faced nothing compared to the threats that local Russian journalists faced. Russian investigative reporters are, to some extent, my heroes. I mean, the kind of work that they do under the kind of conditions. I mean, it's, you know, I had tremendous, tremendous privileges. It was pretty hard for the Russian authorities to come after me because I work for the New York Times. But in a regional capital, a journalist at a newspaper or a website who started examining the finances of a local Russian official and came up with some sort of dirt, you know, that would have been a problem for him or her. And I think, one of the pieces that I wrote in the series that won the Pulitzer was essentially about how journalists in the Moscow suburbs, and these are local Russian journalists, were facing huge pressures, physical violence, their websites being shut down, their newspapers being closed down. And, the aspect of the culture that I was deeply troubling was that there was this real impunity there, that authorities could do this to these journalists because they were actually the ones who enforced the laws, and there was no one, they were accountable to no one. There was certainly no tradition of freedom of free speech there like there is in the United States. I do want to emphasize, however, that the issue of freedom of speech in Russia and the press in Russia is different than in a place like China. In China, it is much more controlled by the government. It is much, much more rigid. In Russia, it really depends on what the media is. So soon after Putin took over in 2000, he basically started taking control of all the Russian television stations. Now, the Russian television stations previous to that were not exactly bastions of great journalism. Each one was generally controlled by an oligarch and generally just kind of hammered away at whatever the oligarch's personal point of view was. Nonetheless, they were not controlled by the government. After Putin came into power, he quickly exerted control over the television stations. So the Russian TV news is essentially only a mouthpiece for Kremlin views. There's very little diversity of point of view on there. Certainly, it is unusual to hear, it's not unusual, it's almost unheard of to hear real criticism of Putin on the Russian television. Sometimes you can hear criticism of local officials, but even that's not that common. Radio, there is one television station in Moscow called the Echo of Moscow, Echo Moskvy, and it is kind of like the NPR of Moscow. And there is a lot of diversity of voices on that. There is certainly a lot of criticism of the government on that. It's kind of tolerated by the government as a little bit of an escape valve for the liberal intelligentsia in Russia. In terms of newspapers, there's more freedom in newspapers. And online is entirely free. There's no censorship online. You can basically say whatever you want online. Again, if you do it in an organized way and you go after specific officials and you start looking at their personal corruption, that's when you get into trouble. But if you basically, you know, have a website where you discuss the government and policies like that and you're critical of them in a sort of a policy-oriented way, you generally will not get into trouble, generally. Same thing with social media. Russia has a very, very active social media space, Facebook, Twitter. There are a couple of Russian websites that are very, very popular and are not censored at all. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I have that impression as well. I mean, I think there's been more of a turning inward. Even when I was, it was interesting, even when I was leaving in 2011, that was, I mean, you know, when I was there, it was not, things have gotten a little bit more tense, obviously, since I left. The West put in sanctions against Russia over Crimea. Russia retaliated. You know, they've now banned the import of food from Europe and the United States to Russia. You know, you can't get the thing people always talk about in Russia. You can't get cheese from France and Russia. They have a joke. You can get Belarusian cheese, which is essentially cheese that's been smuggled into Russia from France through Belarus. And it's repackaged as Belarusian cheese, which is kind of funny if you've been to Belarus. So even since I've been, even when I was leaving, there was a sense of more turning inward. I think it's been very damaging to civil society, and very damaging to the country, to the country's kind of development. I think that the Russian security elite, the Kremlin, the people around Putin would say, we are a country under attack, under a siege. We can't be spending a lot of time examining our own faults or flaws, given that the West is trying to get us, the West is trying to invade us. There are a lot of conspiracy theories out there, essentially, that Hillary Clinton wants to take over Siberia. I don't know if you've ever heard of these. Exactly. And it's a specific, what's that? Right, exactly. There's an even very specific one where there's something that circulates in the Russian cyberspace where Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, is said to have specifically said that the U.S. Should own Siberia as kind of an extension of Alaska. Siberia has a lot of wealth because of oil and gas. So it's just not, we're not talking about barren Siberia. We're talking, Siberia is to some extent a jewel, given there's mining and there's all these other natural resources. One of the big tragedies is what you have essentially because of this is that many of the country's elites see their future outside of Russia. And many young people see their future outside of Russia. And that is extremely tragic. It's tragic for the future of the country. And you talk to a lot of the elite at some of the best universities in Moscow and St. Petersburg and some of these other major cities, and they talk about seeing their future in the West. A couple of years ago, there were two Nobel Prizes that were awarded to Russians who had left. One worked, I believe, in England, and I think another one worked in Germany and the United States. And there was a lot of talk in Russia about that. How is it that, you know, the best and the brightest, are leaving us, this so-called brain drain? I think for young people in particular, this is going to become a major issue. That, if the country remains so inwardly turned, if under Putin, the society remains to some extent kind of suffocating, you could have this problem where there is a major people fleeing to the West. The people around Putin might say they're just traitors to the motherland, and I get that. But it is what it is. And I think at some point, Russia is going to have to address that. You know, historically, the Russian exile is like a classic figure in history, right? So many great in Paris, in London. Lenin himself was in exile. Dostoevsky. I mean, so many, even Pushkin, so many major figures have gone into exile. And of course, if you look at the 70s and 80s and 90s, so many Soviet Jews left the country. And Putin himself has acknowledged that that is a huge tragedy for Russia. Many of the Soviet Jews who left, or Russian Jews, or Jews from the other former Soviet countries, they ended up in Israel and the United States. And there are people like Sergey Brin, who is one of the founders of Google. And if you look at the high-tech industry in Israel, which is an incredible industry, if any of you use Waze, for example, that was created by Israelis. A lot of them are Israelis who were born in the Soviet Union. And so that just gives you one aspect. Most of the Jews have left the former Soviet Union and Russia. Now what you're finding are others are leaving. Non-Jews are leaving. And they're going to Germany. They're going to London. And what's so interesting is that London especially has become like this haven for exiles. And not even just exiles, but also the Russian elite who are intertwined with the Russian government or Russian industry, a lot of them are keeping their families in London. So there are numerous flights that go back and forth between Moscow and London. And there are some Russian businessmen who keep their wives and children in London, and they go back and forth every weekend. When at this small school where I sent my children in Moscow, it was a small little private school. It was a kind of the progressive elite sent their kids there. And if you talk to the parents, a lot of them talked about, I want my children to go to this school because I want them to learn kind of creative thinking and problem solving. I want them to learn English. Everyone there learned English. And I want them to know all this stuff because I want them to have the opportunity to have a future outside of Russia if need be. Some of my, when my children left, they maintained friendships with some of those kids at the school. And they learned that some of them went, after my children left, some of them, their friends left the school to go to boarding school in Europe. And that was part of the idea of the Russian elite, especially the Russian progressive elite, sending, we have to ensure that our children have opportunities outside of Russia, because things are tough now, but if they get much tougher, they have to have a way to escape. Other questions? Right. Right, and he can be a president for, I believe they change it to 6 years, so he can be president for 12 years. He came back in 2000, I'm trying to think. Anyways, I think he can be in there till 2020 or 24. I don't know. I mean, it's totally unknowable. One of the interesting things is, the whole security structure and the whole structure of corruption in Moscow, Putin holds it all together. And so I don't think anyone wants him to leave. I certainly think a lot of the elite don't. A lot of elite who are kind of making money or have power don't want him to leave because, in a society without real laws, and they're not really there are no real laws in Russia, the thing that holds them together is Putin's authority and Putin's power, and the uncertainty that would exist if Putin left. I mean, the whole place could be turned upside down. His number two is Medvedev, who was the former president, is now back as prime minister. Would he take over? No one really knows. There could be just a tremendous fight among the elite for power after that. And having said that, Putin has given no indication that he wants to step down or move on. So, I would not at all be surprised if he's in power for another 10 years, 20 years, or until he dies. Like the benign dictator. Yeah. Although, some would argue he's not that benign, but, others would argue that he's not a dictator. I think it's important to not look at Russia through this complete black and white lens. Putin is not a Soviet leader. He doesn't wield power in the same way. Russia is a much, much different place than it was in Soviet times. The relationship between Moscow and Washington is much different. It is certainly under there are certainly tremendous tensions now and tremendous strains, but it is nothing like it was between Moscow and Washington during the Cold War. Things are certainly much more civil. There are definitely areas of agreement. And, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that Russia is a much weaker country than it was under Soviet times. I mean, it still has a vast nuclear arsenal, but it's a much smaller country geographically. It has far fewer people. You know, Russia only has about 140 million people, and the population is declining. They have a huge problem with that. People are not having babies. Life expectancy ain't so great. People are not that healthy. You know, it's so I think it is not a country that, you know, is rising fast. They're basically trying to keep things where they are. And again, with the economy doing so poorly, given where oil prices are, you know, they're facing a lot of challenges. Yes. I mean, above all, Russia wants to be treated with respect. That is by far the biggest issue for Russians. They want Obama or whoever is Obama's successor to treat them like a co-equal, even though Russia is not really a co-equal. Obviously, I mean, China is certainly much more of an issue economically, much more of a challenger economically than Russia is. You know, what's so interesting about what's happening now is that they have wound themselves into such a frenzy in Moscow. They have really used the media to just drum into the people how under threat Russia is from the West. The propaganda on the Russian TV news is just relentless, totally relentless. It will be very interesting to see what will happen when another thaw comes, and it will inevitably come. How they are going to calm things down with the Russian people. I mean, Putin's popularity is still sky high. I mean, it's sky high in part because the Russian TV ensures that it is sky high. But when the new president comes in, and whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whoever, and tries to create a new relationship with Russia, it'll be very interesting to see how the Russian side handles that. I mean, if it's Trump, it'll be quite fascinating to see Trump facing off against Putin. Other questions? Yes. Yeah. Yes. There isn't. And what's so fascinating about what's happened with the Russian Orthodox Church is it is essentially taken on the role that it occupied under the czars. So you have communism come in 1917, and all of a sudden, you know, the church is destroyed. I mean, under Stalin especially, thousands of churches, the actual buildings were just demolished all over Russia. And it was a godless country, and religion was suppressed tremendously. It was barely allowed to exist. Although actually during World War II, they tried to use it a little bit to rally the people. But leaving that aside, then communism collapses, Soviet Union collapses in 1991, and all of a sudden the church rises again, and the elite, the Russian elite, the Russian government kind of reasserts itself and reasserts that relationship with the church, and they start feeding off each other, or they create this very symbiotic relationship. So the Russian church, the Russian Orthodox Church, is with tremendous power in Moscow and tremendous power with the with the Russian government. And it's a sort of a fascinating thing. I will say that, you know, Russia was under the czars and under the Soviet Union, Russia was a tremendously anti-Semitic country. It is far less anti-Semitic now than it was before as a country. There's certainly some anti-Semitism there. The government is not anti-Semitic at all. You know, of course, there are not many Jews left. You know, that is one aspect that has changed. So I think Putin has gone a long way to address that. Russia has also found, I think, a way to coexist with its Muslim population that is arguably much more successful than what occurs in Western Europe. There's an enormous Muslim population in Moscow, in Russia. I don't know the numbers, maybe 15 or 20 million. Moscow is the largest, as far as I know, I think Moscow is the largest Muslim city in a non-Muslim country in the world. There are maybe 1 million or 2 million Muslims in Moscow. They are largely from Central Asia and the Caucasus, you know, Azerbaijan or Turkmenistan or Tajikistan. You know, they're the laborers, they're the underclass, they do a lot of the work in Moscow. They're not especially religious. They're certainly not religious like Saudis or Egyptians. You know, you'll find they drink and they're it's a different kind of Islam. Having said that, they are Muslim. And Russia has done, I would not say that Russia has assimilated them, but Russia has done, I think, a pretty good job at kind of finding a way to create a real relationship there. At the same time, of course, Russia has faced, you know, terrible insurgencies in the Caucasus regions, especially in Chechnya and a region next to it called Dagestan. And these are essentially Muslim kind of jihadist insurgencies. And so there have been two wars in Chechnya. Putin actually made his name through those two wars. And an insurgency in Chechnya specifically that has been ongoing. And, you know, there are some even in America who say we should go after the jihadists like Putin has gone after the jihadists in Chechnya. I don't know if you saw this, but there have been some comments about, I think Trump made this comment about how, we need to go after the terrorist families. That is a Russian strategy. In Chechnya, if you commit a terrorist act, they have the Chechenian secret security services will often go after your family. And, take your home, arrest your brothers or sisters or parents, and hold you as a kind of hostage. And they credit that strategy with being very, very, very successful. It's obviously a brutal, brutal strategy that violates all sorts of international rules and international treaties. Having said that, they say it works. Yes? So it's a great question. What Russia has done historically, and it's a very smart strategy, is to create what are often called frozen conflicts. What they do is in Georgia, in Azerbaijan, in Armenia, and now in Ukraine especially, they will inject these insurgencies at a low level and keep what they are able to do is modulate them very easily, increase them, decrease them, increase them to decrease them to create instability. And by creating that instability, you essentially don't allow the country to really align itself with the enemy. So I can pretty much guarantee you that if I come back to talk to you folks in 20 years, that the situation in Ukraine will be exactly the same. That area of eastern Ukraine that borders Russia, that Russia considers part of its zone of influence and is filled with ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, will remain unstable for a very long time. It is in Putin's interest to ensure that that area is not stable. Because if that area is stable and Ukraine is completely stable, then Ukraine could consider joining NATO and Ukraine could consider joining the EU. NATO will never let Ukraine in if there is that low-level insurgency there. And it's the same thing with Georgia. So, you know, there was a war in Georgia. There are these two breakaway provinces in Georgia called South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And, you know, they are aligned with Russia. And Russia, if Russia wanted to, it could annex them just as Russia annexed Crimea. Russia doesn't need to. What Russia wants is to keep Georgia off balance because Georgia, particularly under the previous president, Saakashvili, tilted tremendously toward the United States. And Russia was deeply concerned that Georgia was going to try to join NATO. So boom, you create a low-level war, you foment these insurgencies, and Georgia's done. Georgia will never be able to join NATO as long as there is these insurgencies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great question. I don't know the answer. I mean,
we're sending more people to the Baltic states now.
Yeah, exactly.
NATO troops to the Baltic states.
I mean, you know, the Baltics in particular are a really, you know, a kind of festering area for Russia. They have ethnic Russians who live in them. You know, Russia control. I mean, just imagine if, you know, the United States split apart and all of a sudden, you know, Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina became, you know, allied with Russia. I mean, these are countries that the Soviet Union controlled and are now in NATO and in the EU. Now, the people want to be in NATO and in the EU. They do not want to be aligned with Russia. I mean, they never wanted to be part of the Soviet Union. So let's just stipulate that. But having said that, it is deeply upsetting to Moscow that this exists. And there's also a sense of betrayal. There is this kind of disagreement about whether or not Bill Clinton assured Boris Yeltsin that the Baltic states would never join NATO. There's been a long-standing disagreement about that. In Moscow, you will hear repeatedly that the United States promised us that NATO would not, that even the former Soviet satellites in Eastern Europe, but leaving those aside, that the former Soviet republics would not become part of NATO. I mean, NATO loomed large over the Soviet Union for 40 years, 50 years. And now all of a sudden it's in this former Soviet Union. I mean, that's a kind of a crazy thing for the Kremlin. You have essentially American tanks right up against the Russian border. And there have already been all sorts of, you know, spying incidents and things like that between, especially Estonia is the most anti-Russian of the three Baltic states. It is very, you know, ethnically, it is essentially very allied with Finland, has a small, it was always incredibly hostile to Moscow. So there's been a lot of spycraft between those two countries. I mean, that's also a great question. I mean, I think he might need NATO because he needs an enemy, right? I mean, when you foment an external enemy, you're able to distract people from internal problems. And Russia certainly has tremendous internal problems, economic problems, for example. I mean, look, that's not just Russia. Every country does that. American leaders do that as well, right? I mean, terrorism is certainly a problem and something to worry about. But there, you know, the water in Flint, Michigan, or there are other problems in the United States that also kill far more people. I mean, I don't think the water in Flint kills people, but there are other things that kill far more people that are harder challenges to address. And so, I mean, Democrats might argue that it's the same thing with illegal immigration. I mean, there's a lot of great information out there. There is, there's certainly a lot of blogs and smaller websites that focus a lot on the former Soviet Union. Our Russia coverage, I think, continues to be great. We have several fantastic foreign correspondents in Russia. You know, one of the sad aspects, and this is a totally different topic of conversation, but you know, the newspaper industry and journalism in general has been under tremendous pressure, economic pressure, as our business model has changed, as the internet has risen, as people no longer get their news from the print newspaper. And as a result, over the last 20 years, the number of foreign correspondents around the world has declined sharply. So there are very few American news organizations with foreign correspondents in Moscow. The New York Times, the Washington Post, that's probably about it. The Wall Street Journal, and then of course, and the wire services, but that's pretty much it. The news services like the Associated Press or Reuters or Bloomberg. You know, there are more in Beijing, largely for the economic reasons, because the economy is such an important story there. But in the kind of post newspaper era, in the internet era, there's been a real fragmentation, because it's very expensive to maintain a core of foreign correspondents, a lot of news organizations have just closed their doors, the doors of these bureaus. And so, you know, as a result, there's been a rise of these smaller news organizations that are doing some of these specialized reporting. Yes. Yeah, it's a really good question. Do people care at all? I mean, I think there's certainly some people who care about it. There are some parallels, I think, between Russia and China in this respect. You know, there's been tremendous environmental devastation in China as well from industry, less extractive and more sort of coal extraction, but also just factories. And obviously, as you know, the pollution in China is terrible. In Moscow, a lot of the environmental devastation occurred, you know, in places that away from population centers, whether, largely in Siberia. I did some coverage of that. I did some coverage of environmental organizations. But just as civil society overall, there was a lot of crackdown on civil society. There was certainly a crackdown on some environmental organizations by government officials who were getting money, you know, who corrupt money from these big businesses, whether it's logging companies, oil companies, gas companies. So, you know, as often is the case in these countries, general, like, low-level or typical environmental degradation doesn't really get that much attention. It's only when it's causes massive problems and the government just can't ignore it and you can no longer buy off someone with bribes, does the government react. One of the, you know, if you guys have ever heard of Lake Baikal, so Lake Baikal is in Siberia. It has, and this is one of the most extraordinary facts I've ever heard. It has 20% of the world's fresh water in this one lake in Siberia. It's tremendously deep and it's gorgeous. So there was a paper mill on the banks of Lake Baikal. And one of the stories I wrote when I was there was about the back and forth about whether to keep this paper mill open or closed. It functioned during the Soviet era and it, was terribly polluted. It discharged a terrible amount of pollution in the Soviet era. You know, then it closed for environmental reasons and economic reasons, but it was jobs, right? People in Siberia need jobs. So leaving aside the issue of environment or corruption, it also becomes an issue similar to the kind of issues that we face in Alaska or in the United States. On the one hand, you know, if you close this factory, hundreds of people lose their jobs and they can't get salaries and they can't feed their families. On the other hand, you know, you have this jewel, one of the most pristine places in the world on the planet that is being slowly despoiled by this factory. And so there were a lot of tensions like that all over Russia. Other questions? I mean, I actually don't have that much expertise on it. And it became more and more of a pressing issue after I left, when it really became clear that global warming was changing dramatically, drastically, the ability to essentially do things in the Arctic. I think this is a real example where the Kremlin wants to assert Russian authority. It's almost like they see it as, all right, we're all even now, right? We're all at the starting line in the Arctic and what happens with the Arctic and the kind of the post-climate change era. Now is our chance to get ahead. Now is our chance to stake a claim there. Now is our chance to ensure that we really, control as much territory as possible, mining rights, extraction rights, shipping rights. And so I think the Russians are pretty focused on it. And of course, to the Russian point of view, I think they think we've always been there. We know more about this place than anyone, right? We know more about this, certainly more about this place than the United States or the Canadians. They're certainly correct to some extent. They do know the Arctic really well. Part of the country is in the Arctic. For the United States, it's a little bit different, right? You have Alaska, but the rest of the country obviously has no relationship to the Arctic. Other questions? Come on, guys. What else you got? Yes. I mean, it's a great question. There are tremendous problems with productivity in Russia. And part of that is just the legacy of Soviet times. You know, the old Soviet joke, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. You know, after the, you know, without the tradition of capitalism, there's not really any, there was not really, for decades, there was no real incentive system to work. The incentive was to get around the rules, right? The incentive was to lie and cheat and get around the rules. So, you know, then the Soviet Union collapses, some sort of communism, some sort of capitalism starts taking hold, but it has been extremely difficult for some companies, especially these kind of mid-level companies that don't have ties to the West, some regional factory, who are competing, if they want to compete with the West, it is very difficult for them to get the same kind of productivity. They have huge problems with absenteeism, lateness, and alcoholism at these factories. It has been very, very slow in changing. I often spoke to Western managers who had come in the 90s and bought Russian factories, and they just say it was just terribly, terribly challenging to try to institute the sort of Western work rules, Western sense of order and management in order to create the kind of culture of accountability and, you know, value that you had in the West. Now, having said that, there were many, certainly many glimpses of Russia quickly coming into the modern era in terms of service and capitalism. The most obvious example is Aeroflot. You know, under Soviet times, Aeroflot was obviously the butt of jokes. The service was considered to be terrible. It was a classic, you know, monopolist, right? They didn't have to compete with anyone. They didn't have to try harder because they wouldn't lose anything, right? Well, then when communism collapses, over time, Aeroflot really turned things around. They got all Western planes. They flew only Airbus planes. And they sent their entire staff to training in the West in terms of courtesy and in terms of service, in terms of respect. It got to the point where I was flying back between New York and Moscow several times a year. I always took Aeroflot. I never, you know, you can fly directly between New York and Moscow on Aeroflot, at that time between Aeroflot or Delta. And I much preferred to take Aeroflot because I just thought the quality was better. And when I used to tell people that in the United States, and they just would look at me like I was crazy because the image of Aeroflot is just, you know, certainly so terrible. Same thing with fast food. I mean, the Western fast food chains moved in very quickly into Russia. McDonald's was obviously the most famous. If you walked into a McDonald's in Russia, you know, the level of service was not dissimilar to the level of service that you would see in the United States. They really worked hard. McDonald's really worked hard to bring in that culture of service. It is something that never really existed in Russia. And of course, that has a kind of a kind of spreads throughout the whole economy, because if you're competing against McDonald's and McDonald's is treating customers much better than you are, people will go to McDonald's and you will lose your customers. So native Russian companies or Russian-owned restaurants suddenly had to compete on the level of service. So that kind of raises the bar for everyone. I think some of these big industrial outfits, these factories and smelters, they don't have that kind of competitions yet. And so I think it's been harder for them to change that sort of culture of, you know, that kind of monopolist culture. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, generally speaking, people, when I was there, and I think things have gotten worse, but when I was there, people were more willing to talk to me than I expected. I was actually kind of surprised by that. Average people were more willing to talk to me, especially about issues of local concern. So you'd go to some place and you do a story about something that is a little bit more locally focused, and everyone would talk to you. People were generally weren't hugely concerned about just talking about local issues. And yet there was also a very outspoken opposition in Moscow. It's small and it was constantly under pressure. But all they had was their ability to speak out. They had no authority. They had no money. They had no real ability to do anything against the government. So all they really had, the small opposition, the small human rights groups in Moscow, all they really had were their ability to talk to journalists, their ability to kind of get their word out. So, you know, I was often pleasantly surprised at the willingness of people to talk with me. I do think, and speaking of correspondents now in Moscow, that things have gotten worse, that there's been much more of a chill. And I did experience that sometimes. Sometimes it was very hard for me to get regional officials to talk to me because they were too scared that if Moscow found out that they were talking to an American journalist, they would get in trouble. Now I think it's even harder to get people in Moscow to talk to you, officials in Moscow to talk to you. People are just much more concerned about that. And also, I mean, it was always very hard to penetrate the Kremlin itself. It was sometimes even hard to get Kremlin press officials to talk to you, even though that was supposed to be their job. When I was there, the Kremlin went periodically back and they kind of boomerang back and forth between hating the Western press and trying to make nice to the Western press. And they hired a very fancy American New York-based public relations firm to try to cultivate ties between Western journalists and the Kremlin. Then they fired them. You know, they took us all to dinner to try to kind of smooth things over, and then they wouldn't talk to us for months. So, you know, it was to some extent, it was a little bit of a metaphor for Russia's deep ambivalence about the West and about whether or not they loved us, hated us, wanted to be affirmed by us, wanted us to affirm them. It was, you know, they're extremely conflicted about that. Sort of a little bit like Alaska's relationship to the lower 48, right? Other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
So when you returned,
it wasn't. It's interesting. When we left in 2006, we talked. The Times hired like a kind of relocation specialist to help us transition to Russia. A woman in New York who we went and talked to a little bit about what the transition would be like, and she said to us interestingly that for a lot of families, coming back is harder than leaving. Because, you know, when I was in Moscow, I was special, right? There weren't a lot of people like me in Moscow, right? There were not that many Americans, not that many foreign correspondents. So you feel very special. It's very exciting. You have a tremendous amount of independence. If I woke up one morning and be like, yeah, I'll go to Vladivostok in the Far East, or I'll go to Turkmenistan tomorrow, or I want to go to Ukraine or Estonia, I could just do it, you know? That's tremendously exciting, you know, and then you come back to New York and, you know, I became an editor when I came back to New York. I had to come to the same office every day. I lived in a neighborhood of Brooklyn where everyone is like me. And so, you know, that is a little bit striking. Having said that, it really turned out for us that moving there was much more traumatic than moving home. Largely because of our children. Because when we moved there and we put our children in this Russian school, it was just a year or 18 months of a lot of anxiety, chaos, trauma, temper tantrums, tears. After that, it was amazing. But the first year or two was really tough. And, you know, when we got... And then they surmounted that and, you know, ended up being awesome Russian speakers. And, you know, by the time we left, no one knew that they were even American. I tell this anecdote in this article that I wrote where Russia has this really annoying thing where if you want to go to a tourist site, they'll charge foreigners like 600 times what they'll charge Russians. So like to get into the Hermitage, which is this famous museum in St. Petersburg, you know, it's maybe like, I don't know, a buck for a Russian and like $20 for an American. And always just in rubles. And always just kind of drove us nuts. So in the last couple of years when we were there, we would send our kids up to buy the tickets because they spoke perfect accentless Russian. And our kids would just buy the tickets, get the Russian price. And, you know, we'd save a lot of money. It would be our little quiet revenge against that stupid policy. But anyway, so when we got there, it was pretty traumatic. The transition was traumatic because of the fact that our kids were in this Russian school. When we got back, it was actually pretty mellow. Our kids transitioned back to being in Brooklyn and being in New York City pretty easily. And, you know, it wasn't, and I ended up being fine despite the fact that I was a desk jockey coming to the office every day. You know, I just found other areas to excite me. Yeah, totally. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the great strengths and weaknesses of the United States is that, you know, we're pretty isolated from the rest of the world geographically. And, you know, we can be kind of parochial, I think, for that reason. You know, there are a lot of Americans who don't even have passports and have not traveled abroad. Traveling abroad is, you know, it just really broadens your perspective. Hearing how others feel about America, pros and cons, and, you know, America's an awesome country, but it certainly has its challenges, it certainly has its problems. And hearing how people feel about how America asserts itself on the world stage is really interesting, and it's really, I think, important to understand. So having that window onto the Russian perspective was to me, you know, sort of life changing. And it did allow it does allow me now to kind of look at the world a little bit differently, look at American policy a little differently. I mean, it's a sort of a cliche that the longer you spend abroad, the more your eyes are open to your own home, right? And I think for me that was definitely true. It made me look at America much differently, and often much more positively, actually, because one of the aspects of living abroad is you suddenly realize all the things you've been taking for granted at home, right? Certain of the privileges and the rights that we have in the United States, you know, the vast majority of the world doesn't have. And we kind of take it for granted sometimes, right?
Well, and not only that, but, you know, the narrow.
Exactly.
That,
and all the news focuses often on the negative. Exactly. Exactly. I think so. I mean, it's a really good question. One of the things that I don't edit Russia stories. I have a much different job than I ever had before. Right now, I basically am the newsroom leader who oversees all our digital operations. So I oversee our website, our mobile apps. But one of the things that I often talk to the people who work for me about is the importance of seeing what you're doing through the lens of your readers. And that's a really important virtue or characteristic, or it's something to be keeping in mind no matter what. And it's something I thought a lot about when I was in Russia, because I thought a lot about how can I translate this country to people who live in the United States? How can I tell this story in a way that will resonate with the person who's living in Anchorage or Dallas or Miami or San Francisco? And thinking about your audience, thinking about what your audience understands, what your audience wants, it's very, very important. And I think all of us presume too often that our audience wants what we want and our audience knows what we know. And, you know, the vast majority of the time, that's not true. That's wrong. In product development, in digital product development, there is a saying, it's kind of a cliche, but it's actually, I think in this case, totally true. It's you are not your user. And, to some extent, it's how I tried to live as a foreign correspondent or work as a foreign correspondent. I am not my audience. And now as I oversee digital platforms, I think about the same thing. I am not my audience. What does my audience understand about what I'm trying to do or what the New York Times is trying to do on these digital platforms? There's not that much similarity between my job in Russia and my job now, but there is that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Different in what respect? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like that.
It's a great question. I mean, you know, I'll just throw it back to you by just asking you, you know, what is the major difference between digital news and print news? So what access, but what's the biggest difference? There's that, but what's the biggest difference? I'm sorry, I guess let me narrow the question a little bit. What's the biggest difference for the journalist? All right, so I print a newspaper, right? I give you the newspaper, right? Print a newspaper, right? Right, but how do I know when I give you the print newspaper what you've read? Right. So we have tremendous feedback loops now that we never had before. We not only know what you read, we know how you read it, when you read it, what device you've read it on. We know what you like, what you don't like. We can get your comments on stuff. This is a vastly different world. In the print era, we just printed stuff and put it out there, and we had very little sense of what worked and what didn't work. In the digital world, we spent a lot of time trying to learn from our audience. What worked? Why are you reading this? Why did this story get tremendous traffic, tremendous engagement, and that story not? You know, was it the topic? Was it the way we shaped it? Was it the voice? Was it the form? Was it the structure? There's all these feedback loops that exist now that are tremendously valuable to us. You know, in the old days, we used to assume that everyone loved everything because we didn't know any different, and you know that was kind of the arrogance of journalists, right? Well, I think we're pretty confident now that the stuff that we put out in the newspaper in the old days, not everyone loved it. We just didn't know, and we were turned a blind eye to it. Now, I mean, I, as the person who's in charge of all our digital operations, I look very closely at all our analytics, and I see which stories are working well and which stories are not working well. It doesn't mean those numbers are determinative. I don't kill stories because they didn't get traffic. That's not what the New York Times is. But I do use those analytics to help inform my judgments as a journalist. I can tell that, you know, the way you framed this story, this is a really interesting topic, but I think you framed this story in a way that was super boring or super uninteresting or super dense or super complicated for the average person. We need to find a way to do it differently. I mean, we can actually do stuff now where we can take the same story and we can cut the audience in half, the digital audience in half, and give one half the audience one headline and the other half the audience a second headline and figure out which headline is more popular. And that really can tell us, well, what resonates with the audience? Now, of course, you can take that off a cliff, right? There are people who do clickbait websites and all these kind of cheesy things to try to get numbers. The New York Times doesn't do that. But we have to be extremely sensitive to what our audience wants. Because no one wants to write stories or publish stories that are not being read, right? That's not the point of why we're here. And so anyway, that's a long-winded answer that, you know, what we do now is dramatically different than what we did even when I was in Moscow. I mean, we've been in the internet era for 25 years, but the last 2-3 years for journalists, things have drastically accelerated. I mean, in a way that you just can't even imagine.
So do good access?
Yes, yes. They have good access to the internet in general. It's nothing like China. The kind of restrictions that exist in China do not exist at all in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the TV is just still so dominant. It's still where the vast majority of Russians get their news. That anything the New York Times publishes in English is just a tiny drop in an ocean. Having said that, you know, Russia, like a lot of countries, Russians, like a lot of people in a lot of countries, are very sensitive to how they're portrayed in the American media. They have this kind of, you know, as I said before, this kind of conflicted relationship with the United States and the American media. They love it and they hate it. They want to be affirmed. They want to be praised. And they really shrink from this idea that they're repelled or repulsed when they're criticized by America. Or, you know, there's a famous quote, I believe it's from Pushkin, but I maybe was quoting it, but it's along the lines of, you know, I can insult Russia as much as I want, but if the foreigner does, I'm going to punch him in the nose. And I mean, that sort of makes sense. I think Americans are the same way. If a Russian journalist came in here and wrote some incredibly critical stuff about what's going on in America, we'd be like, you know, who the hell are you, right? Why are you passing judgment on us? You don't know the first thing about America. You have no right to pass judgment on us. Go away. And so, you know, it's even worse in a place, or even more complicated and complex in a place like Russia, which does have all these feelings of superiority and inferiority, and they were something and now they're, then they weren't something and now they're trying to be something again. So, you know, there's a lot of distortion there. Yes. Mm-hmm. In terms of people who want to become journalists? I mean, it's a great question. The field is changing so rapidly that it's almost like any advice I'd give right now would might expire in a year or two. But I do think, and I talk a lot to journalists. The other reason I'm here, not only at the invitation of the Humanities Forum, but it's, I also in the last couple of days have been talking to the Alaska Press Club, and I've been talking to a lot of journalists about their work. You know, the thing I always say, and this has the virtue of actually being true, is that despite the fact that the industry is changing so rapidly, despite the fact that we've moved so rapidly to these digital platforms, despite the fact that there are a lot of bells and whistles on a lot of stuff that's being done in digital, at the end of the day, the most important thing is great reporting and great writing and great journalism. We have moved, the Times has moved very, very rapidly to the era of mobile. I presume a lot of you read the New York Times on your phones, especially younger people. And I presume that others here might read the New York Times or various publications on your tablets and certainly on your computer screens. But let's speak specifically to a phone. So the phone, it has a much smaller screen, obviously, than a tablet and certainly than a desktop computer. When we started moving very rapidly to a phone, and by the way, more than half of our digital traffic, more than half of our digital traffic is on phones right now. More than half. Phones and tablets as opposed to desktop. When that was occurring, there was tremendous anxiety in the newsroom of the New York Times that people would not want to read our best journalism on the phone because it was a smaller screen. There was concern that people would just want to snack on little stuff on the phone. You know, you're waiting for the elevator for 30 seconds, you read something on the phone, you're on the line at Starbucks, you're at your dentist's office, you read something quickly, that's it. That has proven not to be true. Some of our best works of long-form journalism, so-called literary journalism that we do, 6,000-word, 8,000-word stories, people read them on the phone, they read their entire stories on the phone. Our engagement and our traffic for some of our best journalism is just as good, if not better, on the phone than on the desktop. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it, right? Because the phone is with you all the time, right? You can start a story on phone, you can finish a story on the phone. A desktop computer is more of a kind of an appointment thing. Like, you're often there during your workday. You may not be there at night, right? You may not, certainly not be there on weekends, right? So it has been very heartening to us to discover that in the mobile era, the values that have attracted people to the New York Times have endured, and that people are coming to us just as much on the phone. I don't want to speak too lightly about this because the Times is facing a lot of challenges in terms of the move to the digital era. Generally speaking, print newspapers are more profitable than digital operations. So we're trying to figure out how to navigate the transition from print to digital. But having said that, our readership has remained very, very strong. Questions? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. I'm not entirely sure that the word dissonant is even the correct word in these days, because to me, it's a little bit provocative. It really, really recalls the Soviet era times when. It's more nuanced now. Now, I don't want to minimize it. There are certainly people who in Russia who come under tremendous pressure. But the kind of things that happened under Stalin in particular, but even Brezhnev or the late Soviet era, those do not generally occur in Russia. People are not being sent away to psychiatric hospitals for 20 years. They're certainly not being sent to labor camps for, 30 years. They certainly are not being executed in the middle of the night like they were under Stalin. But, and this is a big but, there is a lot of pressure that the security state can bring against you if you cause too many problems. And what I mean by that is, it's a kind of a classic thing. If you speak out against the authorities in Russia and you are just yourself, you generally will not get into trouble. You can go on the internet and say, forgive my language, but, well, I won't say a curse word, but you can curse out Putin on the internet. Nobody cares, right? Nobody cares. You can say whatever the hell you want on Twitter, on Facebook, on the Russian website. Generally, nobody cares, right? If you start organizing in a really coherent way and start getting a lot of followers, that is when you come under pressure. And that's really sort of a metaphor for why TV, the Kremlin has exerted so much control over TV and generally leaves alone media with far less reach. They care about organizing and organizations. They care much less about single actors. Under the era of Stalin or Brezhnev, single actors got in trouble as well, right? That's not an issue right now. If you keep your head down now and you grumble about something at a bar, nothing really is really going to happen to you. There are opposition newspapers in Russia that, the most famous opposition newspaper is called Novaya Gazeta. They run all sorts of anti-government stuff, anti-Kremlin stuff, anti-Putin stuff all the time. Now, they do come under tremendous pressure. They do come under harassment. The security services do go after them, but they publish. This radio station, Echo Moskvy, same thing. So you will hear on the air, on this station, people criticizing the Kremlin in ways that would never exist in Soviet times. So I think it's important to understand that nuance. I do think things that there has been, there are more restrictions now than there were when I was there. But it hasn't not reached the stage. Certainly it's not like China. Certainly it is, it occupies this kind of middle ground. It's open to caricature because everyone has in their mind the Soviet Union and what happened in the Soviet Union. Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's far more complicated. And it's more challenging. It can be darker, than I'm saying. But generally, it's not. Yes? Mrs. Clinton was one of the architects of the so-called reset with Russia, which occurred in Putin's first term, which did have some successes, had some successes in arms control and other areas. I think that she has an understanding of Russia, whether you agree or not with her understanding of it. I think it's something that she's thought a lot about. I think she has a fairly good relationship with the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, as does Kerry. Look, I think the current relationship is certainly one of a lot of distrust. I think it has been deeply dispiriting to Obama what has happened, especially given one of his big focuses has been arms control and, creating a nuclear-free planet. And there were a lot of agreements, a lot of post-Cold War agreements between the United States and Russia about decommissioning old weapons, securing nuclear weapons to avoid them being, stolen by a terrorist. Slowly over time, Putin has essentially canceled some of those agreements, in part because, they required American security personnel to be on Russian territory and Russian security personnel to be on American territory. Just to get back to your original question, I don't see a tremendous amount of sophistication in the American political establishment on Russia. Having said that, it's a very, very hard issue. Putin is extremely smart. He's a very canny strategist. Victories for him are, I guess I would say the question is there a way to come up with less of a zero-sum game between the United States and Russia, where it is not necessarily that victories for Putin are losses for the United States? And, I think the jury's still out on that. Anyone else? Okay. All right. Thank you all.